Hey everyone, welcome to the podcast for Cultural Reformation. I'm Dr. Michael Thiessen here with our founder and president and world traveler, Dr. Joe Boot. And this week we will set up for the Ezra East Conference happening this weekend in Ingersoll, Ontario. Stay tuned. Well, everyone, this is a podcast for Cultural Reformation brought to you by the Ezra Institute, where we equip current and emerging Christian cultural leaders with a robust biblical worldview through in-person training programs and a wide variety of print and digital resources. Welcome to the show, everyone. We're going to talk a little about immigration, and it's such an important topic that we are having a weekend conference about this subject matter very soon. So November 1st, 2025, this weekend in Ingersoll, Ontario, Joe will be joined by Nate Wright and Elizabeth Patola and David Haskell. And we're really excited for these speakers to be addressing important topics such as Islam and immigration and the cultural tension that grows out of that. You know, Joe, good to see you. We were together yesterday. We've been together in New York. You're still down in Tennessee, about to fly up to Canada. I thought we'd set up this conversation with New York because we were just there. And right now, a number of new polls have come out to show that Zohran Mamdani is actually leading in the polls to win the New York political election for mayor. So the five-day Manhattan Institute survey closed on Sunday, and it shows that Mamdani is leading with a 43% chance of voter support, followed by Cuomo at 28%, and the Republican nominee falling way back to just 19% chance. So here we have headlines all across America. We've got podcasts and newsrooms covering this, and they're saying it's very possible for New York City that had that experienced the bombing of the Twin Towers having a Muslim mayor.
Well, it's great to be back. I know that listeners, viewers will be aware that I wasn't on the last couple of weeks of our podcast for Cultural Reformation because I was on some much needed vacation, and it's been straight back into it in the last week or so because I'm on a US speaking tour, as you said, at the moment, and we've been in New York, Tennessee, heading up to Canada this week for our conference, as you said, and then back down to Phoenix because I'll be speaking there and also will be in studio with TPUSA in Phoenix next week. So we're looking forward to all of that. So we're kind of flying around here and there and in the meantime, seeking to make sure that we're continuing our series here on Christianity and politics. So we appreciate our viewers and listeners' flexibility with some of this. But you're right to say that we're facing something of a remarkable change or shift in the West at the moment in terms of political influence for growing immigrant populations. And you've mentioned the forthcoming mayoral elections in New York City. In the United Kingdom, actually, Michael, we have had this situation for a long time. The mayor of London, Sadiq Khan, is a Muslim and at the same time a leftist. That's something that's probably worth teasing out at some point as well. In fact, in the United Kingdom, I think it's at least five major cities in the UK now have Muslim mayors. We've got the appearance now in the UK of strategic Islamic voting. So that is MPs getting into their Houses of Parliament who aren't there because they're part of the Labour Party or the Conservative Party, but who have simply run on specifically Islamic issues, an Islamic ticket, if you will, within the Muslim community. So, for example, the Gaza issue, where we have politicians, MPs running purely on the issue of, say, Gaza, and then being elected as effectively independents into the House purely on a Muslim ticket issue. So the issue of immigration is a significant one, and it's confronting the Western world, and particularly Christians, in trying to evaluate, well, what is a biblical understanding of immigration? What is a scriptural view? How should Christians think about the issue? And how, in particular, do we deal with more belligerent movements that have arisen as a result of mass migration from other parts of the world? And that would include the growing influence of Islam in the Western world at the present time.
Yeah, Joe, we know that this issue of migration and the influence of other religions in the West has been going on for a time. When did we see such an influx? You know, here in the United States, they're using words like invasion. And sometimes I feel like that's a proper understanding of the situation. When did this increase in immigration, migration to North America actually start happening in such a way that would, you know, change the demographics of North America so significantly?
Okay.
Yeah, as you say, the visibility of other religions and their political influence has been going on for a while. I didn't mention previously, a moment ago, the fact that the First Minister of Scotland, until very recently, was a Muslim and would be celebrating Ramadan at the Scottish Parliament. Recently, we had a Hindu Prime Minister in the UK, Rishi Sunak, who was celebrating Diwali at 10 Downing Street. I mean, these are, when you look at it in the context of the history of the nation, these are, in a sense, shocking developments. And a lot of people don't really understand the history of, or not really looked into the history of migration into the West. Let's take just very quickly the United States. There were three major waves that are probably important to mention. The first was a wave of migrants in the 19th century between 1820 and 1880. That was about 3.5 million people, but most of those people were from the British Isles and Germany. So you're talking about migration into the United States from basically culturally Christian countries. You have the arrival of Irish Catholics as well during and after the Great Famine. That's really well known. You know, a lot of the sort of Irish history, even in what we'd have called the Old West, came from that migration period. But once again, even though it's Roman Catholic into a predominantly Protestant nation, you're still talking about basically Christian peoples. Then you had a second wave into the United States at the end of the 19th and early part of the 20th century. And this wave, that's 1880 through about 1921. These are from Southern and Eastern Europe as well as Asia. And a lot of these people were Italian, Polish, Russian migrants into the United States. Now, obviously, these are quite different cultures. But again, if you think about that, Italy, Russia, Poland, you're still talking about people from historically Christian or Christianized countries. You have got now, of course, the big influence of Marxism and atheism in these migrant populations. But Italy, Poland in particular, these are still historically Christian contexts, and Russia. Then you have the 1965 and following period, the sort of third major wave of people. They're coming from around the globe. And that period, 1965 onwards, that's still going on. And so, I mean, in the US, of course, a lot of the migration has been coming up from Latin America. And although it's brought different problems with it, the drug trade, sex trafficking, and the gangs and the issues that are talked about politically today, a lot of the cultural peoples coming out of Latin America have also been influenced by Christianity. So I would say that there are all kinds of problems associated with uncontrolled borders, whether the people are coming out of historically Christian lands or not. Those problems need to be addressed. I think the critical problem in the West that Europe is seeing in a way that as yet the United States isn't, there is the growing influence of Islam in America in certain cities and certain, you think in Minnesota, for example, certain states.
Minneapolis.
But not to the same extent as Europe, that has seen vast swathes of people coming from Islamic cultures. And it is interesting. I mean, guess what we're saying here is that not all immigration is alike, because it very much will depend on the cultural background, the religious worldview, and the social issues that migrants are bringing with them. If you look at Canada, you would talk about basically again several waves of migrants very quickly. The one that you had again, you had migration in the 19th century, obviously out of largely Christian Europe, but then from the 1940s through the 1960s and on, the 1940s through the 1960s, you had the post-war wave again into Canada, mainly European migrants, Italy, Portugal, and the British Isles. The driving factors of that for Canada were, of course, post-war reconstruction. There was a lot more demand for labor in Canada, and so a lot of people from the Mediterranean, from Italy and Portugal, arrived to fill these jobs. And this kind of migration was not problematic. It was not destabilizing for Canada, just like the early periods of migration into the United States were not destabilizing because they weren't religiously destabilizing. But then you had a big policy shift in Canada in the 1960s. You had this points-based system introduced. And so a lot more migration was opened up for people from outside of Europe. And the 1970s onward to the present is considered the fifth wave of migration. And those source countries tended to be developing countries, Asia, the Caribbean, and others. You had the Immigration Act of 1976, which revised Canada's immigration policies. And then you had sort of government targets, and you start to have actually a design. This is not sort of incidental migration. You actually have intentional mass migration where governments are trying to hit targets for migrants that are coming from all kinds of developing countries around the world. And then you start to see the massive increase of the influence of both Hindu and Islamic populations politically, socially, and culturally. So that Britain, you had the what is called the Windrush of in the 1960s and 70s, where people largely from the Caribbean islands, again, these are people who are largely Christians, at least in a general sense, they're in Christianized cultures, coming to help with post-war reconstruction, sort of sons of the empire, if you will, Michael, who feel British and want to be British and are coming to Britain because they love Britain. And then you had the steady creation of the British Commonwealth, the end of the British Empire, and the British Commonwealth, citizens of the Commonwealth, many of whom felt British, wanting to come and live and work in Britain. And that sort of early Windrush migration was not problematic. They were integrated because they felt British and they wanted to be British, and they came to be part of Britain. It's in the last 25, 30 years or so where you've had this sort of designed, government-designed mass migration. Tony Blair in Britain, for example, said his goal was to rub the right's nose in diversity. That's what he said. Their goal was to destabilize the Christian center and to do that through mass migration so that we could say, well, we're no longer a Christian country. That's been the problematic migration into Britain, into Europe, into Canada, and more recently into the United States. Obviously, the US has had this problem with a poorer southern border, with people actually coming from all over the world because they think they can get on the gravy train through the southern border. And obviously, the Trump administration has been addressing that problem. But this really, I think, brings us probably to the nub of our discussion around, you know, what is a biblical view of migration? Because you hear a lot of Christians talk as though, well, the stranger, the alien, come one, come all, we don't need to worry about this or have concerns about this. And to do so, to have a concern about it, is to be accused of sort of xenophobia or racism, or that you've got some kind of prejudicial problem, rather than actually looking at scripture and asking, well, what is a biblical approach to these questions?
Yeah, let's go very tactile for a moment. So we talked about these waves of immigration, and as you were thinking about it, I can think, oh, you know, that's right. I grew up in Guelph, Ontario, and we could travel over to Kitchener, and every year there was this wonderful Oktoberfest. I think the original name of Kitchener was New Berlin. I think the original name of Kitchener.
That's correct.
Just the other day, Sarah and I discovered in Cincinnati, downtown Cincinnati, there's this wonderful German, it's called Brauhaus, you know, the brew house. And you can go in, you can look at, you can actually put your stein in a locker. I grew up in Guelph. Guelph was where, you know, many of the Italian immigrants migrated in southern Ontario. We used to have a place called The Ward, which was literally where all the Italians lived together. And you could get fantastic Italian food. There's areas where you can go into, you know, you can go into Chinatown in virtually any major city. You can go into places where the Portuguese, and we first feel it. I just want to be tactile. We first feel it in the food, right? Because they're bringing exotic food in. It's a new free market. And so often new immigrants thrive on running restaurants, and you're being exposed to this great food, the new spice. And but as we reflect on it, that can actually, that's a manifestation of culture. That is the peoples of the world bringing part of their culture to North America. And in that sense, you know, that might be pop culture, that might be skin deep culture. In that sense, it's a blessing. You know, we live in Georgetown, Kentucky, and I'm always wondering, you know, when are we going to get a good Indian restaurant nearby? That's fantastic. Got fantastic curry. But Joe, that's not the issue that we're getting at, in the sense that, what you've just mentioned, there's been an intentional strategy. And let's talk about the political philosophy or the religious philosophy behind that strategy, which then completely ignores the worldview issues, the legal issues that are being brought with each different people group. You know, you mentioned, you know, people immigrating from Mexico, they might be Protestant, they might be Catholic, but some of the cultural issues that they're going to be dealing with is they've grown up in a lawless society. And so they might not be familiar with Western law. And even the most law-abiding citizen is not used to trusting police, right? So they're bringing their cultural ideas. And of course, there was a worldview driving this, especially in Canada, that we're most aware of. There was this philosophy of immigration that really was promoting multiculturalism. And you've just touched on it with the comment about Tony Blair, but can you elaborate on why would a politician say, I want to promote diversity of worldviews, of world religions? We want to be, when they say multicultural, they really mean we want to be polytheistic. We want to, all religions are equal. So before we kind of get into the Christian response, Joe, and we're just going to be able to touch on this week, everyone, this is going to be a short show. Joe's got to jump on a plane, and you should go to the conference on the weekend. You know, if you're not signed up, go to EzraInstitute.com and sign up for the conference. Joe, explain why a secular politician would think that intentionally immigrating Muslims or Hindus is on par with immigrating Christians.
Mm-hmm. Well, the background to it is probably important, which is that with the conclusion of the Second World War, you had 10 million people roughly displaced, largely from what was the Soviet Union, USSR, and Eastern Europe, and they were moving westward. But it was also true of people, some peoples within Western Europe. For example, Michael, I lived amongst the Dutch diaspora in southern Ontario for a number of years. Most of those people came, Christian people, came from post-war Europe that had been, for example, leveled. Cities like Rotterdam in the Netherlands, where my grandfather was from, leveled during the Second World War. So the nations were doing, and as you know, there was the League of Nations prior to this, and the UN was being formed, is they were looking at a sort of historical and social challenge or problem, which is, what do you do with people who are fleeing their country because it's been destroyed, or because they're facing persecution or oppression? And in 1948, you had the Declaration of Human Rights, which dealt with things like refugees and so on. And one of the things in that declaration, Michael, was everyone has the right to leave any country, including his own. Now, you and I would probably agree that a person should have the right to leave their country, right? During the COVID era, when people were trapped in Canada, for example, and couldn't leave, or re-enter in the same way, the freedom to leave and enter your own country was becoming problematic for a certain segments of the population. We would have objected to that. We would agree that if you suddenly are being threatened with death as a Christian for being a Christian, and you want to get your family to safety, you'd want to say, well, a man should be able to leave his country. The problem then becomes, though, what obligation do other nations then have, if any, to a person who is fleeing their country? And so that was the problem that they were sort of wrestling with. And so you have this Declaration of Human Rights, which was developed to deal with a real, let's say, time-limited, really, problem of this massive group of refugees out of Europe. And so they were trying to come up with a rules-based system that was designed, let's put the best spin on it, that there was a compassionate design to say, well, what do we do with Dutch people whose homes have been destroyed and they're trying to leave the country? What do we do with people from Eastern Europe whose homes and livelihoods and everything has been totally destroyed by years of war? And so that's the sort of origin of the discussion about refugees. The problem is that over time, that whole system became gradually more and more abused. Now, what you're now referring to is an ideology that starts to develop out of that for some people. And some of the ideologues, some of the people involved in this, had a much broader agenda of not just internationalism, which was what you've described about appreciating the diverse contributions of other cultures, their food, their dress, and so on, and a form of legal application to enter a country, perhaps based on your skills or whatever, toward a globalist ideology that says that international borders really ought to be broken down, that nation states are basically evil, that they're wrong, and that we should be aiming toward. But I mean, men like philosophers like Bertrand Russell and many of the framers of the of many of these UN, UNESCO type documents and so forth, like Julian Huxley.
They were
globalists. They really believed that nations, and of course related to that, families, in the Christian sense, were bad things. That they were negative for the human race. That we should be moving towards a global government and a homogenized globalist culture, under a regime of humanistic secular international law. Abraham Kuyper was writing about this problem right back in the latter part of the 19th and early part of the 20th century, the desire to destroy nations. He said that, look, originally the international order and the laws-based system was drawn up so that we could recognize and protect both great and small nations and their right to exist and not be dominated or illegally destroyed by other nations and have some international order imposed on them. And he said that is now subtly shifting. This is Abraham Kuyper talking about this, shifting to actually know a new model of destroying the nations and their distinctiveness for a borderless Europe. So he anticipated something that actually wasn't realized, I think, if memory serves, and forgive me if I'm wrong on this, but I think it was 1993, if one of our listeners might correct me, but I think it, going from memory, it was 1993, the European Union. Kuyper anticipates, looking at this ideology, this globalist philosophy, and this sort of globalist secular religion of human rights law, he saw it as morphing from something originally designed to protect the independence of nations, which we were seeing destroyed during World War II, to a globalist ideology that destroyed nations and their borders, and enforced on them a kind of homogenized culture. So in answer to your question, why would a Tony Blair basically impose upon Britain and say, I'm going to rub the right's nose in diversity? Why would he want to do that, to destroy Britishness, to destroy the British nation? Well, it's this globalist ideological agenda. It's that really the independent boundaries of the nations, their sovereign right to exist and control who enters or doesn't enter their country, this is really a bad thing, and that this is really rooted in the Christian cultures of Europe, where you saw the nation state basically develop. And of course, out of that coming places like the United States, Canada, Australia, New Zealand. This idea of nation states under the rule of law under God, which emerged from the context, of course, Michael, of Christendom, which in and of itself was an area of Christianity. If you want to know what is Christendom, a geographic area that was seen as submitted to Christ, that this is a bad thing, and that the way we can destroy the notion that Britain or Canada it are Christian nations is by, through globalist ideology, of flooding those countries purposefully with people of completely different religious commitments. That's why not all immigration is the same, because immigration from Christian contexts is a very different kettle of fish to immigration from, say, cultures committed to Islamic law, that is Sharia law, and a different idea of social order. But the one type of immigration is far less destabilizing. You can steadily enculturate those people into the society. You can enculturate them. You can integrate them. Whereas what Tony Blair was doing, to use him as the one example of a British prime minister doing this deliberately, was actually what it created was ghettoization, not integration. To the point where now we have in Britain entire cities, basically, certainly entire areas of certain cities that are practically Sharia controlled areas. They are zones that are governed and ruled by an Islamic social order.
Islamic view of diet, Islamic view of food, Sharia courts, well over 100 of them operating up and down the country with the permission of the civil government to arbitrate in terms of basically Sharia law. That is a very different kind of migration to what was originally envisioned of allowing a certain number of displaced peoples from Europe to settle in Western countries. So that's the journey, in a sense, from 1948 to the early 2000s in Tony Blair's Britain.
Okay, just as we close off, I think we only have another 7 minutes. Joe, explain to me the difference between church court, because I think something that... just as a point of application, this is somewhere within sphere sovereignty, we would accept that the church has a certain amount of authority in the individual's life and that certain issues within the church ought to be examined. So a Christian nation having a fully functioning church would have situations where people don't need to go to the public court. We would advocate for that. But now, of course, you've just illustrated the example of immigrating Muslims to a country where now you're having Sharia law imposed in an area under permission. So someone might innocently say, well, hey, if you want the church to have a certain amount of freedom to run Christian courts, what's the difference between that and Muslims running their courts? Now, the question already shows that a lack of vision for one law rule for all, and it misunderstands, of course, the types of things. But I want you to explain that, because someone just might be listening and say, "Hey, wait a minute, you're trading one thing for another." There, just explain this idea of Sharia law being imposed and the difference between Muslims imposing that and then Christians saying, "Hey, there are certain things that should be handled within the church and not going all of the way to government."
Yeah, well, one has to do with the nature and character of sphere sovereignty and the nature of a free society. A free society is going to have public or constitutional law. It's going to have civil private law. For example, if you've got a dispute with somebody over a land boundary or for example, even in cases of divorce and custody of children, you've got civil private law, and then you've got non-civil private law. This is the arena of private organizations and institutions that have their own internal disciplines and structures. And so the Christian church, really from the time when St. Paul mandated the creation of Christian courts to the church in Corinth, has developed Christian courts of arbitration. That's the realm of non-civil private law. When you have a church court to deal with heresy in the church or church discipline, or even when the Christian courts have historically been courts of arbitration, where basically these are courts of mediation and arbitration where by choice, people can say, well, actually, rather than taking my land dispute or my business dispute to the civil court, I'm going to take it to this non-civil private court because we both are Christians and we both agree to bind ourselves to the conclusion of this this arbitration. And that's often a way, of course, of saving money too. So the key difference is that within a church court or a Christian court or court of arbitration, whatever you're going to call it, the rules-based system that the Christian world and life view and biblical law is nascent there. It's within the history of the nation, right? This is not a foreign law order. So when you look at the history of the civil law, the non-civil private law, as a civil private law and non-civil private law, it's drawn from the same source. Its root, the common law tradition, is in the scriptures, in the word of God. It's not and it's not a foreign law order. So Britain, for example, take the United Kingdom, is a constitutionally Christian country. The Coronation Oath Act
constitute Britain as a legally Christian country. And the state is bound by law. If you look at the coronation and the coronation oath that was even taken by Charles III recently, it constitutes the nation as Christian. And so every public state event, in a sense, is a Christian event. So the issue is that within social order, the way religion and law work, because all law is ultimately religious in character, is that that has a centuries-long history in the United Kingdom since the time of Alfred the Great in the 9th century. Christian law has unfolded itself, and church courts obviously continue that tradition. Islamic law has no history within the nation, has no formal recognition in law by the state, except this permission for these, in modern times, in the last few years, for these Sharia courts to operate. So Sharia introduces the law of a foreign god, a foreign law, into a historically Christian common law context. And this is not so a private court of arbitration in a Christian church is not a rival law order to the constitutional law of the state or the civil law, the private civil law of the state, whereas Sharia law is. Sharia law doesn't view marriage in the same way that Christianity and Christian law in Britain views marriage, for example, is just one example. So, or the question of debts and loans, you know, Islamic finance and banking. This is a totally foreign law order. And this is what would bring it into, and I think what we can do, Michael, is we've kind of introduced the topic this week. We can tackle next week. Let's do a part two on immigration in the follow-up to the conference. And let's tease out so that we don't give away the content of what we're going to be saying at the conference. We can talk about that biblical view of immigration. How does the Bible itself handle the question of immigration and dealing with the tension that the Christian feels between hospitality and sanctuary for the foreigner, the alien, the oppressed, and the maintenance of community? Because that's the rub of this debate, at the very heart of this debate for Christians and for us to deal with in terms of a scriptural worldview, is how do you deal with the tension? How do we address the tension, the biblical tension that's there, and the tension that the Apostle Paul felt as a Jew, as a Benjamite, as a former Pharisee, to being an Israelite of Israelites, you know, as to the keeping of the law, you know, blameless, and being the apostle to the Gentiles, right? How is it that we maintain the Christian obligation, which is what in the early part of the 20th century, the Christian nations were dealing with? How do you show hospitality, kindness to the stranger and the alien, as scripture requires, whilst maintaining community? But when you bring in a rival law order, which brings in a rival God, you used the word earlier, Michael, polytheism, which was exactly right. You're not showing hospitality in the biblical sense of when you come here, you come in under our law order and our social order, under the God of the system, the God of this social order, and you're recognizing that. No, you're importing a foreign God and a rival law order, which is the essence of the politics of civil war. You have just brought in a foreign God, which is a destabilizing now element into a historically Christian context. What's allowed that, of course, has been de-Christianization, what we call secularization, humanistic neo-paganism. It's the model of the Roman Empire, which is the Tony Blairs fundamentally of this world think, well, the ultimate order and authority is that of the state, of the neo-pagan state, of the secular state. They wouldn't necessarily use that religious language, but they would say, we can treat Christianity and Islam and Hinduism and Buddhism and occultism and Jedi warriors and whatever else it may be, all in the same way, as citizens of this globalist order of the secular state, and we will rule over them and arbitrate between them. It's the sort of Caesaro status, humanistic status model, and they, in many respects, didn't recognize that that would not be accepted by these rival law orders that they were bringing into their illusion of a multicultural, as in polytheistic, society. The only way that Rome held together on that model was by pure militaristic force. If you want to incorporate various gods into a status system, you must first require absolute loyalty to Caesar, which is what was required. And it was held together by the sheer power and might of the military power of the Roman Empire. That's of course the difference.
So you got there for sure with two of my questions. So with my second question, you got there. The difference between the Christian church having a Christian court within its local body for the purpose of solving civil disputes or personal disputes is not to be confused with the criminal court that sits to deal with criminal behavior within the Christian society. So within the Christian society, there's your criminal court, and then there's some civil disputes that can be handled. That is all within the framework of the Christian legal mind, the Christian framework, law structure, as you mentioned. Sharia, when you're coming into pockets, I can't remember the word you used for pockets, neighborhoods. You use the prop.
Yeah,
ghettos. What's happening in those ghettos? It's not that Sharia is just dealing with some civil disputes under the authority of the criminal law. It is a replacement, because down here you have a total different law concept. So they're executing civil and criminal law under a totally different law structure.
Well, they're not. To be precise, they're not supposed to be doing that. The point is, here's the mistake. Look, the civil authority looks at the Muslim community and looks at Islam and thinks, well, that's basically the same as the church courts or private arbitration over here. So, of course, we need to be even-handed, because they don't understand the nature of Sharia law. And Sharia law, they're not legally permitted to say, well, we're going to have this person stoned or executed or whatever. But it's supposed to be dealing with largely family issues. But of course, the Sharia law views at every level, whether it's the criminal elements, they don't, and of course it doesn't have the same, Sharia, Islam doesn't recognize the same divisions there anyway in law. The Sharia governs every single aspect of a person's life in Islam. And so they'll take what they can get for now. The goal would be to see Sharia replace. That's what they would say. The Islamists would say, we want to see Sharia law replace. We recognize for the time being, we don't have the power yet to overthrow British law, the common law, but the goal of Islam is to supplant and replace it. So the civil governments, in a sense, are hoodwinked. They think, oh, this is like the non-civil private law of the Christian church. So we can just take pressure off civil courts because they can arbitrate those. And they won't break the civil law, the criminal law of Britain in doing that. But I'm afraid that's not the case. That's not what happens.
Well, and it's not what happens either. Either it's abiding your time and it's not happening that much, or it's a no one's looking and we're going to do what we want under our law structure. Okay, so Joe, before we go any further, everybody, I've got a really important question for Joe in the post show. It's the question of, how can Zohran Mamdani, a professing Muslim, also be a committed communist? And it's going to likely connect to Joe's last thought there on totalitarianism. That I'm going to ask Joe. We're going to get the answer to that question in the post show, along with some other discussions. So join us over there in the next few minutes. Sign up for our Ezra Media Premium Plus in order to join us in our post shows. We're going to ask that juicy question and get the answer just in a few minutes. But for those of you who are listening and you're just an ongoing faithful supporter, we thank you so much. And we want to remind you, of course, Romans 11:36, that from him and through him and to him are all things. To God be the glory. Amen. Okay, either see you next week or over in the post show.